Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every weekday from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis, how are you?
I'm well this morning. I'm actually very excited to have our guest who will join us in the next segment. Our guest is a woman named Cara Da Silva. This is the 10th anniversary of the publication of her book, In Memory's Kitchen, where she's published the collected recipes of the women of the Terezin or the Terezinstadt concentration camp in Czechoslovakia in World War II. And it's just an amazing collection of recipes and food memories from an amazing time and some amazing people.
So. Yeah, and definitely interesting, you know, how different people kind of fought that whole incarceration. And
it speaks to how, you know, people fight being dehumanized, mm-hmm. you know, and food is an important part of what brings us together in culture. But we'll talk more about that with the author of In Memory's Kitchen, Cara Da Silva, later on. But we always start with something in the news. Well, mostly often we start with something in the news. This from the Associated Press, cloned meat and milk spark consumer fears. Exactly.
Ah! Fire.
The government said yesterday it's moving closer to approving meat and milk from cloned animals. Yummy.
Now, that's not artificially inseminated animals. This would actually be cloned, grown in petri dish.
Yeah, this is very Star Trek. I'm scared already. It has drawn some protest from consumer groups.
Imagine that. Oh, yeah.
Now, the biotech industry says that cloning lets breeders do what they've always done, which is select the best animals from the herd for reproduction. Not exactly what they've always done. See, because what's already happening is we have too little genetic diversity on the planet.
Our animals are not biodiverse any longer. Because what we're trying to do is get the perfect sheep or the perfect cow or the perfect pig. What we're doing is we're genetically making them all very, very similar.
And now with cloning, we can make them exactly the same.
Well, I mean, you've heard Francis and I talk about this in the past. You've heard some of our guests talk about this, the expert talk about this in the past. What does that do?
One bug.
Okay. If it kills pig A, it will definitely kill pigs B and C and D and E, which have the exact same DNA.
When you go to a modern agribusiness pork farm, they are sterile inside, and you have to wear surgical gloves and a surgical mask because they're so afraid of any of those pigs getting sick that they pump them full of antibiotics and they treat it like an operating room, a filthy, disgusting operating room, but an operating room.
Civil War operating room.
But
how's that?
Let's just talk about cloning in animals. I mean, it's not exactly my vision of where I want my food to come from, nor is it most people's. But the biotech industry, don't worry, the biotech industry will allay your fears. Here's a quote from Barb Glenn of the Biotechnology Industry Organization. Cloning, allowing the possibility of identifying the healthiest and superior sire boars that are going to be used for breeding purposes. This is a good thing, says she. But a fight is brewing over whether cloned animals, and again, look, if you want to do it or not, we can have a debate mm-hmm. about it. But if you're going to do it, label it.
Let me know.
But the biotech...
You got to let me know.
The biotech industry does not want to let you know. The biotech industry does not wants to not have to label meat from cloned animals. And here's their argument. I love this doublespeak. It's like Orwellian. This is from Barb Glenn of the Biotechnology Industry Organization, as reported in the AP. We feel like the average consumer is going to accept this technology as we move forward. There will not be a label that will indicate this is anything other than the healthy meat and milk. Let's review that one more time. We feel like the average consumer is going to accept this technology as we move forward. Therefore, we don't want to put a label on it. Well, if they're going to accept it, why wouldn't you put a label on it?
I know why. Because you're a toady. That's why.
And you win a toady award.
That's why.
Let me translate this. We feel like the average consumer is going to accept this technology as we move forward because, well, we're not going to tell them about it.
You'll love it. Don't worry. Everything's
fine. They'll
accept
it. They'll never know. That's why.
Everything's fine. We're just going to move ahead and do God knows what to the planet. And
Chris,
if we don't tell you, it won't hurt.
But here's the deal. These organizations, like the Center for Consumer Freedom, which you can find online, which is an industry apologist organization run by their lobbyists, they say, well, the consumers should have the freedom to accept this, and therefore we shouldn't have to label it. And it's just double talk. If the consumer has freedom, look, I don't think we should prohibit things. I don't think we should prohibit trans fats. I don't think we should prohibit these things that are bad for you. But labeling them.
Just give me a choice.
Just give me a choice.
Just give me a choice.
Let me know it's there.
Okay. If I want to pay 50 extra cents for beef that's not cloned, if I want to pay an extra dollar for rice that's not genetically modified, if I want to pay an extra $2 for corn that's not genetically modified, if I want my corn chips to not have genetically engineered corn in them, just let me know. So I'll pay the extra money. I will encourage other people to pay the extra money.
And you know
money.
What? And there are other people out there who are like, you idiot. No,
right.
That's
absolutely.
That's all hog. I was talking to an attorney the other day who's actually involved in the food industry. And he's like, oh, what does organic mean anyway? It's all a bunch of hogwash. I'm like, fine. If you think it's hogwash, then don't buy organic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but he would be against being able to label things as organic or having to label things when they have artificial things in them. And that's not consumer freedom. You want to buy cheaper stuff, that's fine. But here's the deal. The Consumer Federation of America has said years of independent polling, including a survey by the Gallup organization, they're somewhat trusted, the Pew Initiative on Food and Biotechnology, indicate that consumers oppose animal cloning overwhelmingly and wouldn't buy cloned meat and milk, even if the government declared them safe. So put it on the label and let the consumers decide. All you industry guys, all you big corporate guys, you're free market, free market, free market. Well, the free market depends on an informed consumer. Let the market decide.
Stop telling me what's good for me. Stop telling me what I can and cannot have. Stop telling me this is okay. You can have your Teflon. You'll be fine. Don't worry. Just stop telling me all this stuff and tell me what's in it and let me make my own decision. I'm an adult. I'm mature. I'm even relatively intelligent. I want to make my own decisions.
I disagree with the relatively intelligent part. Anyway,
you probably disagree with the adult and mature part too.
So the USDA, we're gonna have a show later in the week talking about a book called Mad Sheep,
The
USDA is a little bit off. They love to fight little guys, but they really don't have the cojones to fight the big folks. Cloned meat and milk. The stories on the AP.
Because the big folks pay them.
Yeah, that's
true.
They are the big folks, as a matter of fact. But you can check that out. That's a story on the Wire today. We're going to be coming up talking to Cara DeSilver, author of In Memory's Kitchen, on the 10th anniversary of the publication of her very important collection of recipes. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest today is Cara DeSilver. She's an award-winning journalist and author whose works appeared in Newsday, The New York Times, Gourmet, Food and Wine, and all sorts of other national great publications. In her book, In Memory's Kitchen, Ms. DeSilver has published a collection of recipes and food memories from the women of Tarazin, which is a concentration camp or a forced ghetto or what's been called a transit camp in Czechoslovakia during World War II. These recipes, written by undernourished and underfed women, were written on scraps of paper or parchment or whatever they could scrounge. Were these recipes recorded to preserve the traditions and culture of these women? Was it a way to build community? Was it an act of defiance and hope? I don't think we can know, but it's one of the most powerful things that Mark and I have read about food in the last 10 years, and we have Cara DeSilver to thank.
Cara DeSilver, welcome to the show.
Thank you. How are you both?
We're doing great, man. I mean, your book is just really profound. I mean, I read it a while ago, and I read it again last night, and it's just one of the most moving things I've read about food, and all I read about is food.
Now, well, it remains that way to me, too, so I can understand your reaction to it.
Can you tell our listeners how this collection of recipes came to be and how it got out and how you came to be in possession of the ability to publish it?
Well, starting with the second part of what you said, I was a member of, I'm a food historian, among other things, and I was a member of the Culinary Historians of New York. And someone there, a woman named Dahlia Carmel, who collects cookbooks of all kinds, suddenly came up to me and told me that she had seen this most extraordinary manuscript shown to her by a friend. And it turned out that that friend was the daughter of the primary author of this extraordinary manuscript. And the manuscript was created in the Terezin concentration camp. It's also commonly known as Theresienstadt, which is the German version of the name. And it was created under extraordinary circumstances because Terezin was a hoax camp. It was a camp that Hitler had set up unbelievably to show that he was being kind to the Jews and good to the Jews, so it was a show place. It was a Potemkin village. It was a facade. But one of the good things about it was that it allowed people, you know, the inmates, who were largely the flower of Czechoslovakian and Central European Jewry, to do things that they might not otherwise have been able to do. So it was a very heavily cultured concentration camp, as bizarre as that sounds. And one of the things that came out of it was this amazing recording of recipes, which, as you said, were set down by starving and malnourished women while in this concentration camp, never knowing when their names would be called for the next transport to a death camp. And the reason that we have it is that one of the primary authors, whose name was Minna Pachter, was dying of starvation. We actually know that and have information about it. And she asked that the book, she asked a friend of hers, if she died, to please try to get the book to her daughter, who was in Palestine. And the daughter was in Palestine and not with her mother, because the mother had refused to go, saying she didn't believe anyone would hurt an old person. And, of course, she was very soon to find out that was not the case. Anyway, the friend took the manuscript. And he when he was released from Terezin after the war, and he took it back to his shop in a little town in Czechoslovakia, and he kept it there. And then one day, 15 years later, a cousin of his, he didn't know how to deliver it to the daughter because of the war, the mother had not had an address. So he just kept it. And 10 years later, a cousin of his came into a shop and said she was going to Israel, because Palestine had then become Israel. And he asked her to keep his deathbed promise to his friend and to take the manuscript with her and find the daughter, whose name was Annie Stern. She did take it. But by the time she got word of where Annie was, it was... Annie had just left, and because it took a while, Annie and her husband and son had just left to live in the United States. After that, the manuscript disappears for 10 years. We don't know where it was or what happened to it. But at the end of that 10 years, a man from Ohio, again, we have no information about him, walked into a meeting of Czech Jews in New York carrying this manuscript.
He just showed up in New York 25 years after the manuscript had been...
No idea what the connection was. And he walked into a meeting of Czech Jews in New York, and he asked if anyone there knew Annie Stern, the daughter. And one woman raised her hand, and she said, "I think I do." And later that day, a full 25 years after her mother had died of starvation in Terezin, Annie's phone rang in a high-rise in Manhattan, and a stranger's voice said, "Hello, is this Annie Stern?" And she said, "Yes." And the voice said, "Then I have a package for you from your mother."
Oh, my God.
And I'm just sitting here. I, you know, it, amazing how this stuff never loses its grip on you. It's so powerful. I've got goosebumps.
You know, I just got goosebumps, right?
It's astounding, and we're going to talk more in just a moment with Cara Da Silva. She's the author of In Memory's Kitchen, a collection of recipes that made its way from mother to daughter over the course of 25 years from a Czechoslovakian concentration camp where it was written to her daughter 25 years later and then to, through Ms. Da Silva's work through us. We'll be talking more with her in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
Today we are proud to present Jackie Naylor.
Once upon a time, New Year's Eve was a night for swank jazz, champagne, and caviar. Ring in 2007 at just such a gathering with us. The Restaurant Guys present a New Year's Eve jazz concert at the Crossroads Theater starring Ms. Jackie Naylor. Jackie's been called the new voice of jazz by Vogue magazine. Jazz Times says, in the never-ending Next Big Thing sweepstakes, bet on Jackie Naylor. She's headlined internationally. She's played with Michael McDonald and David Sanborn. And on New Year's Eve, she'll play to a sold-out crowd at the Crossroads Theater right next to our restaurants. Dine before or after the show at either one of our acclaimed restaurants. There are hotel accommodations within walking distance, one of the best jazz singers in the country, two of the best restaurants in the state, an evening not to be forgotten. Go to stageleft.com or CatherineLombardi.com for details, reservations, and menus, or call 732-828-4444. Put the swank back in New Year's Eve. Spend it with the Restaurant Guys. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Our guest is Cara Da Silva. Her book is In Memory's Kitchen. It's a collection of recipes written down at the Terezin concentration camp, and it's been published as a collection of recipes. Cara, what do you think prompted the women of this camp where food was so scarce to write, of all things, a collection of recipes?
I mean, while they were actually starving to death, they were writing recipes.
While they were starving to death, they were writing recipes.
What do you think caused
it? When I first found this manuscript, or when I was first shown this manuscript, I thought it was an anomaly. It was an unknown form of Holocaust literature. And I assumed it was unique and there were no others because it did seem to me too at first like a very odd thing to do if you're starving to death. But that was really before I had thought the whole thing through and felt it so deeply and been exposed to more survivors, et cetera. I think what they were doing is something that probably since then has been done, not since then, but also before then, have come to be done by people and extremists anywhere who are literate. I think that food is such a powerful identity marker that when, anthropologists will tell you that food ways are the last thing to go when people start becoming hyphenated people. I mean, like Italian-American, Armenian-American, et cetera.
Well, they're the first for the Irish, but for everybody else,
okay.
They're the last thing to go.
Stop that. That's some very good Irish food.
Yeah, I've had two. Both dishes I had were good, but I've been Irish for a long time.
Okay. No so argument about that, although I'm sure even then that there were Irish recipes written down, even during the famine, where people were literate. And, I mean, I just have come to feel in my heart, and also because I've been a food historian and a food writer, and I like you, I think about food and its meaning a great deal of the time, and also just from exposure to people who have expressed feelings about this, that our connection to food is not just the obvious one. I mean, I think that what this book shows more than anything is the capacity of food to nourish not just the body, but the spirit.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of our traditions. It's part of who we are. And I think that, at least what I got from this, is there was this need to pass along, to continue the traditions of the family.
I think that's true. And I think this was in part, in a funny way, because women at that time very typically would create homemade cookbooks to pass on to mm-hmm. their daughter or their daughter-in-law. I think in an odd way that this was a substitute for being able to do that.
We have to listen to the news for a moment or two,
sure,
but I will tell you that reading this book, it's a fascinating cookbook, but it almost has an air of the sacred about it.
I agree with you.
You read the book and it's so moving, it's incredible when you understand where it comes from. It's
yes.
called In Memory's Kitchen. It's by Cara DeSilva. And after the news, we'll be talking more with her about what's actually in the book and how you can pick it up and maybe even use it. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, here with Francis Schott. Together we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon, reach through restaurantguysradio.com, or download our podcast on iTunes.
We're talking today with Cara DeSilva. Her book is In Memory's Kitchen. It's a publication of a collection of recipes written by women in the Terezin concentration camp in Czechoslovakia. It's the 10th anniversary of its publication. It's one of the most moving cookbooks. It's the most moving cookbook we've ever read, and she joins us to talk about it today.
Cara, I want to talk about what I thought was maybe the greatest metaphor of the entire book, and that is the unfinished recipes. Why did you include the unfinished recipes in the book?
Well, in a way, I think they bear witness to the state the women were in when they were writing these down. These women were, in many cases, malnourished to the point of incoherence. They were starving to death. And so I did that throughout. These recipes are not modified in any way for the modern kitchen. So it takes a very professional cook or somebody perhaps using a Czech cookbook or a Central European cookbook in conjunction with them, or a very expert cook to be able to cook from them with any certainty. That's not true of all of them, but it's true of many of them. There are ingredients left out. There are cooking processes reversed. And I found that almost unbearably poignant, given that what they were trying to do was reassert who they were in the face of, a wholesale attempt to exterminate them and their culture, their traditions, their very lives. And I felt it was very important not to make this into, ta-da, a Holocaust cookbook. Really.
That would have been,
I wanted to be very clear that these were dream recipes, that they were remembering a gentler time in their past, and that they were trying to reinforce their identities and share with each other, and as you said before, perhaps create a sense of community, even among the few women who did this. And I'm sure there were other women in the camp, or even men, because men did this too. GIs, at almost exactly the same time, were writing a cookbook in a prisoner of war camp in the Philippines. Food is such a powerful thing, and that's why I think this book was a phenomenon. Why it became one of the New York Times most noteworthy books of the year, why I spoke about it all around the world, why it was written about, and, in Europe and elsewhere. It touched a chord in people. Everyone could identify with this. It was a new way to approach the Holocaust in terms of something we can all understand, our mother's recipes.
I think that one of the things about the Holocaust that people often try to do when they commit horrible acts of aggression, and even in our modern time, is to dehumanize The enemy, whoever the enemy
is.
And when we dehumanize the enemy, you know, that maybe that's how what we have to do is our first step to where we can kill them. Because if they're human and it's someone you can imagine sitting down at a table with and eating their mother's food, it's harder to kill them.
I couldn't agree with you more.
And I think that, you know, it's funny. I'm this has to be on your cookbook shelf, and you have to have read it. And, you know, I have a nephew who's very into food, my nephew Connell, and he's 13. And he's going to get this book, and we're going to talk about it, you know?
That really makes me choke up, because I think that's the most important thing one can do with this, is to pass it on to the next generation and make them understand. And I say that, I mean, with such a full heart. Because we have to keep this going, and this, and understanding going, and the humanizing of it that this book does is so important for that reason alone, because of exactly what you just said.
It's so. You can't help when you read this book, and you can, and you know what you've done so well in this book is to contextualize it. And to contextualize where this book comes from, so that we can all understand it. You know, it wasn't my grandmother, but I understand the power of the book, and I think that it's not about the cooking, but it's about the very act of defiance. These women it was an act of bravery, and it was an act of, you're not going to dehumanize me, and I will find a way to maintain my dignity and my traditions and my humanity.
I think that's exactly what it was, and I think that's I now know of perhaps 20 examples of this kind of cookbook, and I believe that even now, in all the horrible, amid all the horrible things that are going on in the world at the moment, that again, where people are literate and in danger of extermination, that someone somewhere is writing down dream recipes.
Now, let me ask you, is anyone using this book that you know of as a cookbook? Are people actually cooking out of this
there
book
are,
and trying to do that?
There are, yes, there have been. And I hope now that the paperback was just released that there will be more who attempt it. But as I said, it's just very important to understand that that's not the way it's intended. But I do know, and through all my speaking and everything else, I've had people tell me that, among other things, one of the things they've done is chosen one or two of the recipes and worked to recreate them so that they would be effective as food, and made these dishes on an appropriate Jewish holiday or on the Day of Remembrance, in order to memorialize the women of the Holocaust and the men of the Holocaust, really, because, as I said, there were men who did this as well. So certainly there are people doing it that way, and these are drawn, however error-ridden some of them are, these are drawn from the corpus of beautiful Central European cookery.
Yeah, but Nina must have been collecting these tiny little pieces of paper and scraps of paper from various people throughout the camp in order to get this collection together.
Well, we don't know that it was only Nina who did it. And I think it was, we've concluded, the translator, Bianca Brown, was herself interned in Terracine, and she concluded, going through the cookbook, that there were four or five hands in this, so that we know that there were four or five women. But I don't think, I mean, I don't know. It's possible she went throughout the camp, but I think it's more likely that these women were in a bunk together, because there's even a poem, which is the epigraph to the book by a young woman who subsequently died, talking about how the women discussed food all the time, and they did something called cooking with the mouth, meaning there was no food, so they talked
We're going to talk more with Cara Da Silva about her amazing book, In Memory's Kitchen, which details the recipes that came out of the women who were mostly did not survive from Theresienstadt, the concentration camp in Czechoslovakia. It's one of the most, it's the most moving cookbook that's, I believe, ever been written, and we'll be talking more with her in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45.
Economy Paver and Restaurant Supply Company is the oldest dealership in New Jersey. They've been equipping and supplying restaurants since 1932, and they know that to make great food, you need great equipment. You need equipment that doesn't break down, and you can't pay too much for it. Whether you need an emergency replacement or a wholesale kitchen renovation, Economy's knowledge, experience, and integrity are indispensable. Economy Paver and Restaurant Supply is a recognized dealer for all major brands, and they specialize in custom fabrication and ventilation. At Economy, they've got all the tools you need to get the job done, all in one place, all priced right, and delivered to your door. Economy is the only dealer in New Jersey that's an approved for on-site demonstrations of the Rational Combi Oven. The Rational Combi Oven is an innovative combination of convection and adjustable steam oven. It's a powerful and versatile tool in your kitchen's arsenal. They also supply competitively priced paper products and all the non-food supplies every restaurant needs. You can visit the Economy Demo Kitchen on Broad Street in Clifton, New Jersey. You can also visit economysupply.com, then call them at 973-279-5500. That's 973-279-5500.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Our guest today is Cara Da Silva. Her book, In Memory's Kitchen, details the collection of recipes that came from the Terezin concentration camp in Czechoslovakia in World War II. Now, Theresienstadt, or the Terezin concentration camp, that was the show camp that Hitler, many of us who are familiar with World War II history, where Hitler sort of put on a facade of treating the Jews well and actually invited the Danish Red Cross to come, and he fooled them into thinking that Jewish ghettos under the Third Reich were humane places.
Yes.
Can you tell us about how he did that and what Theresienstadt was like?
As I indicated before, it was... the entire camp was, in a way, had a facade of, I can't exactly say literally around it, but there were many things that it had the appearance of being one thing, but were actually another. And the other was awful and pretty bad. And, for instance, a film was made, a propaganda film was made for exactly the same purposes, showing how kind Hitler was being to the Jews. And after the filming was completed, all of the actors, including the children, were sent to the death camps. And prior to the visit of, that you alluded to, prior to the visit of the Red Cross, Terezin was sometimes an incredibly overcrowded place. It was a barracks that I think was built hold 7,000 at maximum, held 60,000 people, something like that. So before the visit of the Danish Red Cross, they thinned out, I'm putting that quotation marks in my head and I hope in my voice.
Of course.
They thinned out the number of people in the concentration camp and sent them to the death camps for appearance's sake, so that when the Danish came, things would look reasonable. They did many other things. They set up a shop that never, you know, that there was a shop and a shop window that they filled with food that never had food in it. They set up a restaurant. Allegedly, they even set up a merry-go-round, which is so beyond bizarre that it's really almost hard to say it.
Yeah.
How the Nazis lived with this deception, you know, but there were many much more dramatic things relating to
And, you know, just from I had read about Terezin, other than the from this cookbook perspective, and they had a, you know, when the Danish Red Cross was there, they had a concert, and they had, you know, freshly painted rooms of people they visited
Absolutely.
With food in the house, and then, of course, those people were killed as soon as the Red Cross left.
Yes, and the husband of the translator, who was also enterazine told me that there were allusions to dining hall number two when there wasn't even dining hall number one under these circumstances. And children were trained to run up to the camp commandant. And while the Danish were there saying things like, "What? Not sardines again, Uncle Rom." As though they had sardines all the time.
Oh my God! Now, in the Terezin concentration camp, these collection of recipes was put together by a woman who was advanced in years, and she had stayed in Czechoslovakia because she felt that, you know, no one would hurt an old person, right?
Yes.
When her children had fled. But it turns out that old people had it particularly tough in the camp.
Yes. They were actually treated worse.
Can you tell us why and how that came about?
Well, I think it was a combination of things, but. Unfortunately, it was also a choice that had to be made to help the young survive. The Jewish Council of Elders and the camp was forced to make some really horrible decisions. And one of them was that the young who had to be put before the old.
Because they had a chance to
survive. Whereas the elderly did not. And that reduced the elderly to horrible conditions. And, I mean, everybody was starving. There was a little more food given to the young. But after that decision was made, the elderly who were already sick and, you know, and emaciated were forced to really scrounge. They were given very little food, and they were forced to scrounge.
And out of this comes a brave woman who collects recipes and sees to and successfully sees, though it takes 50 years, that these recipes are passed on to her daughter. And then, Kara, through your work, that we can read them as well. It's an amazing, amazing story.
Yes, it is. And working on this has been an incredibly humbling experience. And the manuscript that she worked on should have ended up in the Holocaust Museum in Washington.
Right.
Is such a story of survival, however it happened. There were so many hands in this.
Yeah.
So many people, you know, passing it on, taking charge of it, holding it, realizing its importance. And it's ended up in, you know, one of the most important Holocaust memorials in the world.
Yeah.
So I'm going to ask, in the 10 years since you published this, how's it changed things for you? How's it changed you and your outlook and your life?
It was really, I can't say that I was not a really sensitive person before that, because I was, which is one of the reasons that I decided this had to be done. But I think I've been sensitized far beyond what I was then, where I was then, to the immense significance of food, as I said before, way far beyond the physical,
mm-hmm.
and to all that it means to people, spiritually, psychologically, and it's changed me, I suppose, in that I am more aware, but it was an incredibly, you know, it's hard to talk about it even now without
sure.
having
yeah.
tears
sure.
in
Actually,
my eyes.
You know, we're going to take a moment, we're going to collect our thoughts, and we're going to come back and we're going to talk more about this book that comes out of a concentration camp and Holocaust survivors. And we're going to be talking about some of the poems and letters that you included at the end of that book in just a moment. Our guest is Kara De Silva. Her book is In Memory's Kitchen. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, all, welcome back. You're listening to Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants. Our guest is Kara De Silva. Her book is In Memory's Kitchen, which is a collection of recipes for Holocaust survivors, Holocaust internees at the Terezin concentration camp in Czechoslovakia. It is a profound book, and you need to have it, and if you care about food and if you care about humanity at all as it relates to how we come together, you need to get it, and you can find out how to do that on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. At the end of the book, Kara, you've included some poems and letters as well. Why did you do that, and why did you choose the ones you did?
I really didn't. That was what was in the entirety. It was part of the manuscript. And what I was interested in was in publishing the manuscript as it had come out. It was Terezin in its entirety. And some of the poems, they were allusive. It takes some work to be able to understand what they're talking about, but they're also poignant in their own way. The whole idea of somebody sitting there and writing a poem while waiting for a transport is really an overwhelming thing. And I'm sure they weren't self-conscious about it in the way that we look at them now, but it has to have really affected them. And I just want to add, in relation to the question you asked me before the break, that the reason I'm hesitant about talking about how it affected my life is, one, because it affected it so totally that there's almost no way to capture how it affected it, but also because one of the things that you learn when you're working on a book like this is that no matter what's happened to you as a result, good or bad, it is so inconsequential in relation to what you're writing about.
Kara, we have to leave it there because the news is coming up.
Okay.
Or Steve.
Thank you both for allowing me to speak about this important thing.
And as much as this book has affected you, it's affected us, and it'll affect any of you out there who read it. It's really tremendous. It's called In Memory's Kitchen. It's by Kara De Silva. You need to check it out.
We appreciate the work that you did here, Kara. It's really important.
I hope you've enjoyed listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.